Welcome, everybody, to the National Center for Family Philanthropy's monthly topical call for the Community Foundation Network. This call series is on the second Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern for no more than an hour. It's your opportunity to learn from your peers, ask questions of each other, and provide your own tips and insights on the topic of the day. I'm Tony Macklin, a consultant for the Community Foundation Network and guest facilitator for today's call. We'll start with a couple quick logistics. One, as of 3 or 4 months ago, we switched over to the Zoom software that you're using for both audio and video. So you are not muted when you log in, which means if you've got noise in the background, feel free, or you are highly encouraged to mute yourself on your own phone or on your computer when you're not talking or when you're listening. You can use the Zoom toolbar to do that or your own phone's mute button. Second, it's an interactive conversation. Our guest speaker will have some content to tee up based on the topic today, and then hopefully he'll have some questions for you, and we'll get a chance to see what you all are working on today's issue. Last, we're recording this call, and we'll be adding the recording to the network's Dropbox folder for folks who miss it. If you have any troubles accessing that Dropbox, feel free to give me a buzz, if you can give the National Center for Family Philanthropy a buzz, and we'll get you connected. So, on to today's topic. Before we get started, we've got a quick round of introductions. Hopefully we can do just so Phil, our guest speaker, knows who's on the line. So we just go down the list of people who I've got on the thing here and unmute yourself when you get a chance. So Halea, somebody that's about as Halea. Who do we have here? Who's that and what community foundation? I might still be on mute. Who's at 904 area code?
Ms. Joanne Cohen from the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida.
Hi, Joanne.
Hi, Tony.
And Barrett?
Yep, hi, Barrett Christ from Community Foundation for Greater Atlanta.
Okay, 813 area code?
Hi, this is Beverly. Beverly at the Community Foundation of Tampa Bay.
Oh, fantastic. 817 area code.
Vicki Andrews at the North Texas Community Foundation.
Great. 808 area code.
Hi, this is Hannah from Hawaii Community Foundation.
Hey, welcome. 415. Might still be on mute. How about 520?
This is Angie from the Arizona Community Foundation.
Oh, hi, great. Who else do we have here left? Who else hasn't said their name?
Hi, this is Lori O'Keefe from Triangle Community Foundation.
Hi, Lori. Welcome. Amy Beth?
Yes. Hey, Amy Beth from Community Foundation of Greater Memphis. Hey, everybody.
And Colleen? So does that all just Colleen? Okay. Anybody else?
Yep. The Oregon Community Foundation is here as well.
Of
and
course.
Judy Welcome. Smith from the Arizona Community Foundation.
And Ann Engelhardt from the Community Foundation for the Fox Valley region in Appleton, Wisconsin.
Miles Chiquanta from the Hawaii Community Foundation.
Oh, great.
Jay Molino from Community Foundation Sonoma County in Santa Rosa, California.
Great. Well, this is a great turnout for December. Thank you all for coming along. So as a reminder, if you're not muted when you're not talking, go ahead and do that just to sort of keep the noise down. So today's topic is something that was actually requested by a couple of your peers, and it's how to serve donors with cognitive impairment. This came from a conversation at the in-person workshop a couple of months ago, and people were talking about certainly donors and fund advisors and maybe get Alzheimer's, other versions, but cognitive impairments can come from lots of other places, injury, substance abuse, and more. And so there's some of it sort of the art of the service, some of it's an ethics issue, some of it's just like how do you stay on your toes to make sure you can be the best philanthropic advisor to those kinds of folks. We brought in a great person, Phil Purcell, who is a nationally renowned trainer for estate planners and for fundraisers and for gift planners. And for community foundations, he has roots in fundraising and gift planning for universities. He's done that for community foundations. He's taught at the fundraising school in Indianapolis. He's done tons of sessions for the National Association of Charitable Gift Planners and its other previous names before that. He's been a past board member, a member for them. He's been an AFP member, and right now is serving as the Senior Counsel for Philanthropy for the Fellowship of Catholic University Students. He's based in Indiana, although right now is in Louisiana doing some work for his own full-time job. And he was able to take some time out today to guide us through the art and maybe a little bit of the science of working with donors and fund advisors with cognitive impairment. So Phil, I'm going to turn this over to you. I know you've got some things to talk about. You've got some questions to shoot to the audience and then maybe go back and forth from there. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. It's an honor to be on the call with everyone. I am scouting out quiet places. As it turns out, I ended up in my automobile in front of a Starbucks here in Lafayette, Louisiana. But I think I've been here a while and it's been pretty quiet, so I think this will work just fine. What I've done is divided my remarks up into various sections. I thought I'd tell you what these various topical sections are at the front end. And then I've got some thoughts within each section to share and information to share. So if you've got pen and paper, computer, laptop to take notes, you're, of course, welcome to. And after the program's over, if in the following days you have any follow-up questions, I'm happy to take those as well. I've been at the fundraising, planned giving line of work for, you know, about 30 years now. My wife just retired as a middle school special needs teacher. So I'm the youngest of five siblings, my parents, the youngest of families of 7 and 10 respectively. So I've watched a lot of aging relatives as well. So from a personal perspective, as well as a professional perspective, I've encountered a lot with cognitive impairment. I thought I'd begin. My sections are some warning signs, issues. Tony's already highlighted many of those. Thought I'd rattle through some of them. Secondly, I thought I would share some definitions or key terms as we think about this subject matter, both legal terms and common parlance, so to speak. And then thirdly, I'll review some legal concepts, legal documents that we bump into when dealing with this audience. So I thought I'd review some of those, make sure you understood the legal, some of the legal constructs. Next, some philanthropy resources, guides, ethical statements you ought to be sure to have. Then I think spend most of my time in terms of talking with some real life examples, followed by some best practices that I think we should use. And then I'll wrap up with some other resources that might be helpful for all of you. So those are my subject matter areas I'm going to go through. But as Tony indicated, this is interactive. So as I go along, if you have a question, feel free to ask. I'm definitely going to pause at the end of each of these topical sections to encourage your questions. So jot them down and feel free to jump in. And I will be sharing questions as well. So to kick off, in terms of warning signs, as Tony already alluded in the introduction, you know, we run into these kinds of neighbors, donors, friends, family members who exhibit one or more of many of these warning signs. Things like erratic behavior, extreme emotions, some obsessive compulsive activity or thoughts, confusion. Inability to concentrate or difficulty with concentration, memory loss, forgetfulness. You know, any of these kinds of behaviors might be obviously a sign of warning. You know, as I grew up, I have had a number of aunts in particular who developed Alzheimer's, and in many of those cases, they have revealed themselves in either slow or dramatically quick fashion. So these kinds of issues or problems may be seem small or trivial at the outset, but can grow over time as well. So these are some of the warning signs I think we've all seen before. So with that said, let me jump into some definitional terms that I think are important to be aware of. In advertising this program, the label given was cognitive impairment, you know, generally defined as a loss of intellectual function. When you deal with donors and their legal documents and making a gift, The law in most states use other terms to describe these kinds of problematic situations. Things like words like legally incapacitated or legally incompetent. So the words incapacity, incompetent, cognitive impairment at some level are synonyms for each other, but in application, depending upon your state, the state law may choose to use a certain word that denotes what they may or may not be able to do from a legal standpoint, such as, for example, for our audience, complete a gift to your organization. In general, the word incapacity is a lack of mutual or physical capacity to care for their person or property. It can be permanent or temporary. And it doesn't obviously have to be the same. A person could be physically incapacitated, but mentally not incapacitated. So mentally just fine. So perhaps the ability to conduct a transaction such as a charitable gift cannot be necessarily divined by looking at their mere physical incapacity. The mental would be separate. Quite often the word incompetency is used when there are legal matters at hand. Not always. The word incapacity may be used under the law as well. But in either case, there can be a legal finding, an actual legal finding of incompetency or incapacity. Right off the bat, of course, in general, someone under the age of 18 years is deemed to be legally incapable of, say, signing a contract or having a legal commitment. In some states, there are exceptions to the age 18. Now, again, the age 18 is a general age limit. There may be some states with less than 18 years as the drawing line. But there can be exceptions. If, for example, in some states you're under 18 and you're married or in military service, you may not be incapacitated and you can sign a contract or make a gift. A third criteria sometimes is a court hearing where someone under age 18 is declared an emancipated minor. So age can get tricky as well. So we just can't always draw the line with someone under a certain age as to whether they have capacity. Now, of course, that's separate from cognitive impairment, but I thought it relevant to bring that up. In the case of legal incapacity or legal incompetency, then you quite often have some other legal matters that might define it. And for example, in most states, there is a court protocol that would be used to declare someone legally incapacitated or legally incompetent. Now, what court that would oversee this kind of matter would depend on your system in your state. It could be a family court, a district court, a county court, probate court, etc. And the kinds of evidence necessary to have a legal determination of either incapacity or incompetency could vary, but it would include some sort of psychological assessment by a doctor or qualified psychological examiner to help make this determination. And then a final word or definition that crops up in this whole arena of cognitive impairment is the label special needs. And, you know, under federal law, you have special needs if you're institutionalized or have a severe disabling chronic condition as specified by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. So the label special needs is quite often used, especially with children, but not always, as another label for individuals who have some of the warning signs that we've talked about. So let me stop there. We've done, again, a quick overview of warning signs and some words. Any questions, comments from anybody based on what I've said so far? Well, not hearing anything. So I'll push on. I think the important aspect of this, what's fascinating is data research shows that about a half of individuals over age 85 show some form of permanent impairment in their thinking, cognitive impairment, perhaps they've been by a court or legal procedure deemed incapacitated or incompetent. And also recent data from the fundraising world, the planned giving world, suggests an inordinate significant percentage of all deferred gift revenue comes from individuals age 80 and over when they pass. And furthermore, there is a significant amount of changes being made in estate plan gifts for charity by persons age 80 and over. So you have this extreme overlap. You know, I'm now thinking of a Venn diagram. So picture the Venn diagram with a lot of overlap by the 80-year-olds with permanent impairment on the one hand, and yet on the other, representing major philanthropic donors to our organizations through deferred gifts especially, but with a likelihood to make changes to those gifts. So just because someone designated a planned gift for your community foundation and they're at age 80 or so doesn't mean you're locked in for sure. You have to continue to steward and maintain a strong relationship with that person. I often like to tell the story that my mom is 93 years old now. And when I often go to visit her, I think her television is locked in on Barnaby Jones. We cannot get her to change the channel. So I used to think, well, you know, using my mom as a reference point, if she does have a will, and the odds of her ever changing that will are slim to none. But when it comes to philanthropy and gift giving, the data suggests otherwise, that folks who are 80 and above do make changes. So we have to be careful to maintain strong relationships and communication and rapport with those upper age benefactors. Okay, so now I don't hear any questions, comments coming. I'll move on to legal documents and concepts that I think are important in this construct. First of all, you may have heard the term guardianship or conservatorship. Now, a guardianship or conservatorship is usually in most states a court-supervised process where a third party, it could be a relative, it could be someone else, literally has both financial oversight and or personal oversight over the custody, care, medical treatment of the person that they are serving as their guardian. So if you're working with someone who indicated any of those warning signs I talked about, you can make a gentle inquiry to see if perhaps they've been subject to a guardianship or conservatorship proceeding, or do they have a guardian or conservator. Again, this is a court-supervised process. So the guardian or conservator has to regularly submit reports to the court as to the status and care of their ward. And they have to keep records of their medical treatments, of their financial matters, and the like. So it's very closely scrutinized. A second legal concept or documentation that many people may have is the power of attorney. In most states, a power of attorney is a very flexible document, but it can be very powerful. So, for example, powers of attorney may be temporary in time. So if, say, one of your donors is in the hospital for a period of time, but they think it might extend longer and they're not going to be, say, for example, able to make decisions during that time frame, they may have a temporary power of attorney held by a child or loved one who can make decisions on their behalf, including the decisions to make charitable gifts. On the other hand, a power of attorney can be permanent. So, for example, my mom, who's 93, has power of attorney. I am her power of attorney. It's permanent. Now, she is competent. Believe me, she could make her own decisions, but I could make these decisions, financial or health care, on her behalf. Now, obviously, I'm very careful in that regard, and I respect her decisions and her wishes always, and use that very carefully. So again, power of attorneys can be temporary or permanent. They can be what are called springing. That is, when a person only needs power of attorney, does it spring into effect? So it's latent, so to speak, until there's an automobile accident or a stroke or some other debilitating occurrence, and then it comes into effect.
Now, powers of attorney can be either financial oversight, bank accounts, investing, selling a property, and or making charitable gifts, and or they can be caregiving, choosing doctors, rehabilitation services, and the like. So, or a power of attorney can be both. One person can hold all those powers. It's quite common to see, say, one child have the caregiving power of attorney, healthcare power of appointment, it's sometimes called, yet another child having the financial oversight. So that's the power of attorney. A third legal topic would be a special needs trust. Now, special needs trust, we often think of special needs as it relates to children, but that's not necessarily the case. This can apply to adults. And the goal of the special needs trust is to hold and invest assets and provide a flow of income to the special needs beneficiary in such a manner that that person will not be disqualified from Medicaid coverage. And so these special needs trusts have to be carefully drafted, and we'll talk about the lawyers who are expert in this at the end of this conference call. One thing to keep in mind with special needs trust, of course, is that there may be assets left in the trust at the death of the special needs person, and that could be a charitable gift. It would be a bequest from that trust. I mentioned Medicare and Medicaid. Of course, we all should be aware that Medicaid is both a state and federal program providing health coverage for persons whose income is low. And there's a 5-year look back when considering Medicaid applications. So transfers without compensation, that would include charitable gifts within 5 years of the Medicaid application, could trigger a delay in the actual receipt of Medicaid coverage. So the 5-year look back is an examination of any transfers made without compensation, and then they're factored into in a formula to determine when Medicaid coverage can begin. And of course, Medicare then is a federal program for health coverage for persons age 65 and older or who have severe disabilities. Now, the final legal concepts or documents I'd like to mention are the revocable living trust and the will. And they're similar to the extent that they both, between the two, represent perhaps one of the largest sources of deferred charitable gift revenue that your community foundation may receive. A simple bequest and a revocable living trust or will. Now, the revocable living trust is a venue to separate assets for legal purposes relative to probate, but not separating assets for purposes of taxation. So a person who sets up a revocable trust and donates or transfers assets to it are still liable for the income tax on the income of those assets, and those assets are still on their estate for estate tax purposes. And of course, we all know what a will is. Now, some interesting points that come up in these regards is, for example, can your charity serve or your community foundation serve as trustee of a revocable trust? Can you serve as executor of a will? Or if one of your benefactors would ask you as an individual staff member, could you serve as trustee of a trust or as executor of their will? Are you willing and able to do that? And again, at the near the end of this presentation, I'll talk about gift acceptance policies. But under the law of many states, it is possible for a charitable nonprofit organization to serve as trustee of a trust or as executor of an estate. But at the end of the day, my recommendation would be that this would be a matter for decision by your board of directors and only carefully considered under careful examination of the circumstances. So those are some legal concepts and documents I wanted to just mention. Let me pause here and see if any of this has prompted a question or a comment from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I hear someone.
This is,
Phil, this is Tony. While other people might be teeing up, this might be on other folks' minds. So you talked about power of attorney, sort of being a variety of roles, and same with people who are guardians or conservators. Maybe walk through a little bit about how that works with fund agreement. So somebody is a fund advisor, not sorry, the donor making a gift.
Yeah, but 125.
Would that typically take over then for somebody who's a fund advisor automatically?
Yeah, that's a good question, and it's a topic I have later under my best practices. But let's go ahead and talk about it now.
Perfect.
It's a question that I get asked a fair amount. That is, okay, if somebody has the power of attorney, can they supplement themselves for the donor as the advisor? My recommendation in cases like that is, first of all, you're going to have to confirm that they, in fact, have the power of attorney. You know, you don't want to be disrespectful, but you always have to make sure that you're dealing with someone who's being honest with you. And so I would, if I were the Community Foundation, make contact directly with the donor and ask them, have you given, Bob or Mary a power of attorney for your behalf? Now, maybe the donor is not capable of answering or responding, in which case I'd ask the person who's advocating they have power of attorney to share a copy of their power of attorney with your organization. And they do this all the time. I mean, somebody's got power of attorney over healthcare decisions, they share a copy with the doctor. If they have power of attorney over banking, they give a copy of it to the bank to be able to conduct transactions. So it's perfectly legitimate for the Community Foundation to ask the person for a copy of the power of attorney and then to read it and have your local legal counsel read it to see if it in fact gives them that authority. I'll be talking in a minute about a famous Supreme Court case that dealt with power of attorney. Many power of attorney state statutes don't, or attorney documents themselves, don't specifically reference the making of charitable gifts in the power of attorney, which I think is a mistake. I think our thoughtful donors, and this is something community foundations could promote, that is, if you're going to give somebody power of attorney and you want them to make either gift giving decisions or donor advising decisions over DAFs, that authority, be sure to specifically say it in the document. It's quite likely that the document you'll be handed does not have that any specific language about donor advising. But I think legally it could be assumed from a broader authority to make financial decisions on behalf of the person who's incapacitated or impaired. But I would read the document, have your local counsel read it to see if that is a reasonable interpretation. Does that help, Tony?
That does. Any other questions from our team here on the Community Foundation call?
Okay, well, I'll forge ahead then. And there are some important resources in the philanthropic sector. You know, Tony mentioned at the outset that ethics is an important guidepost in this regard, that, we're dealing with someone who's maybe impaired. You've got both legal issues you've got to worry about in terms of if they have a power of attorney or a conservator or a guardian, you've got to deal with them rather than your benefactor or your donor, because they have a ultimate decision making. But there can be ethical issues too, and I should encourage you to make a list and read these. The Donor Bill of Rights, all of these you can easily access online. The Donor Bill of Rights, the Model Standards of Practice for the Charitable Gift Planner, the Association of Fundraising Professionals Ethical Standards. The independent sector has a wonderful statement of ethics that nonprofit organizations may adopt. In addition, the independent sector has the principles of good governance that includes helpful discussion of ethical standards. And then, of course, the National Standards for Community Foundations in its section 16 has a section that talks about honoring donor intent and the law. What's fascinating, you read all of these, and I've read, believe me, all of these documents I've referenced. Rarely do they get into the issue of dealing with those who are impaired specifically. But you do encounter concepts of dealing with donors in a fair fashion, in compliance with the law, of course, avoiding undue influence, a fair and accurate disclosure of the gift. So I would say that even if you're reading one of these ethical standards and there's no specific reference to someone who's incapacitated, clearly the ethical standards apply to those cases, and you should make note of dealing with in an honest, fair, and in an open disclosure kind of way, protecting confidentiality and so forth.
Phil, this is Beverly McLean. I've got a question for you.
Yeah, fire away.
In the event that you've got a relative who has a durable power of attorney for a donor who is no longer of capacity, so let's say they've been deemed to be incapacitated, are we required by law to honor the power of attorney such that that person becomes then the fund advisor?
I would say yes, that's possible. I would ask them for a copy of the durable power of attorney. I would confirm that the donor or original advisor himself or herself is in fact incapacitated. And you could inquire of the circumstances, you know, that created this power of attorney. Now, power of attorneys can be created without the person being incapacitated legally. In your case, it sounds like that is the case. But you can ask for confirmation of that. If there was a court hearing, you could ask for a copy of the court documentation. That's very reasonable to do. And ask for a copy of the power of attorney. Then, as I said before, I think you've got to read that document and have your local legal counsel read it to discern. And I think it's, in most cases, I think it's going to be rare that donor advising or charitable giving per se are going to be referenced in writing in the power of attorney. I don't think we've evolved to that point. Now, I think one byproduct of this teleconference could be that all of you at Community Foundations should put this on your checklist. And you could even weave it into your fund agreements that, you know, if a donor has already established a power of attorney, whether it's springing, durable, or whatever, that they specifically do authorize that person to act on their behalf. You know, we often do this with successor advisors. You know, that kind of language is often built in our gift agreements, but we don't reference the possibility of these power of attorneys or other legal guardians or others. And so that's actual language we could weave into our fund agreements, especially our DAP agreements or our scholarship agreements that might have donor advising with the scholarship or committee membership, for example, to give somebody that has the power of attorney. But by the other flip side of the coin, the donor himself or herself could have their lawyer put that in the power of attorney document as well. So does that help, Beverly?
It helps. This is actually past history. And internally, staff determined that because the fund agreement says when the donor is no longer willing or able to advise on the fund, then there was a default process. So we made the determination not to honor the COA.
Well, I think that's a close call because while I understand that, yes, the person with the power of attorney is, in fact, another human being, a different person, they are acting in the stead of the donor. So that's something else entirely. And I think it could be argued that for purposes of effectuating the donor intent, the power of attorney has the legal authority to do so. So I think there could be a strong argument on their behalf that the power of attorney does give them that authority, even in light of the language you referenced in your fund agreement. And again, it's okay. Because they are acting on behalf of, in the legal stead of the donor. So it's not like, you know, a next door neighbor just suddenly deciding, you know, they're going to start doing this, that kind of thing.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
This is Tony. Before we move on, let's open up to the rest of the group for a second. So you mentioned being able to maybe weave this kind of information into a fund agreement. So question out to everybody who's on this call, has anybody done that already? Maybe Community Foundation wove in this issue of how to deal with the power of attorney or conservators or something?
Our fund agreement defines the advisory period. And so the advisory period and defines the expiration. So we have it written that the advisory period expires upon death, resignation, or incapacity of the fund advisor.
And sorry, this is yourself again?
Hi, yeah, this is Tom in Des Moines, Iowa.
Des Moines. Okay, so Des Moines, yeah. Got at least the capacity piece in the fund agreement. Anybody else?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. That's a very good point, Tony. And I like the language the gentleman mentions, death, resignation, and the third touch point, incapacity. And you'll often see that in agreements, but I think it's the kind of thing that a donor, if they think about this, might want to might reconsider if they realize, especially if the incapacity might be deemed of a potentially temporary nature. And this leads, in fact, to my next section of discussion, a famous case, and these are some specific examples that I think the audience might find interesting. So in Indiana, we had an actual Supreme Court case where two brothers of a very wealthy family sued. One brother sued the other. And over the fact that one of the brothers had a power of attorney over mom's affairs. And mom and dad was deceased. Mom was declared legally incompetent. One son had power of attorney over her financial affairs. And the son with power of attorney wanted to continue the legacy of mom and dad's charitable giving of very significant dollar amounts. The other son without power of attorney disagreed with that and sued, saying that that was an inappropriate depletion of the estate assets and that power of attorney did not give the one son who had the power the right to continue that philanthropy. Long story short, the court cited it was an appeal of a decision in favor of the son who sued, arguing that it was depletion of assets. The son, who was power of attorney, won in front of the Indiana Supreme Court, and they basically held that even though the power of attorney document did not specifically declare that charitable giving could continue under specifically the power of attorney document, that the Indiana law allowed it. And furthermore, the mother and father, before the father passed, before mother became incompetent, had signed what we often refer to as a legacy letter, an ethical will, so to speak, a legacy document saying that their intent was to perpetuate their philanthropy now that the kids were growing up, and that they would turn their attention to their joy and passion of philanthropy. This is the first time I've seen one of these ethical wills or philanthropy statements actually cited in a court case and used as evidence, so to speak, to support the perpetuation of giving under a power of attorney, even though the person was permanently legally incompetent. Very interesting case. Anybody wants to read the case, let me know, and I'll send you a copy of it. That's one case example. Another example I have that you'd find fascinating, you can actually hear this story at NPR, National Public Radio site, and Google the name of the donor, Richard Leroy Walter. Richard Leroy Walter was an honors graduate of Ball State University in Purdue in Indiana. He was homeless in Phoenix and befriended a nurse at a homeless mission in Phoenix, Arizona. And then when he died, he had an approximately $2 to $3 million estate and had left that estate as gifts to the Phoenix Mission, to Purdue and Ball State. And in fact, the nurse who befriended him became the executor of his estate and received a gift from his estate. Now, I've told this story many times, and a lot of mental health advocates that I talk to say, you know, there's a high incidence of mental health issues among the homeless. So the question becomes, was it appropriate for this staff member of a charity to be executor of the estate? Was it appropriate for her to accept a personal gift from the estate? So a very interesting case that raises questions. I'll pause. I've shared two real-life examples with the audience. Any feedback, questions? I've got a couple more I'm going to share, but our time, I know, is what it is. I'll stop here, see if you have any questions, comments to the two cases I've shared. Do your community foundations have policies, procedures that define, describe, when you might be able to be an executor of an estate or accept gifts? Obviously, surviving family might be very concerned that you've extracted undue influence to leverage any personal financial gain from their estate. Let me share a couple more, couple of donors I'm working with right now that raise concerns for me. Well, another example from my past, I had a donor, very wealthy gentleman, very sophisticated corporate executive, who we closed a charitable gift annuity contract with. We had talked about the gift annuity. I explained how it was fixed dollar payments, the tax benefits. He understood, signed the signed the document. And then some months later, called me to say, hey, Phil, I've noticed that these gift annuity payments are a fixed dollar amount, but the stock market has gone up. Why hasn't my income increased? And I sat there thinking, completely puzzled. You know, I said, well, Bob, it wasn't his name. I said, well, Bob, you know, this was a gift annuity. And your payments are fixed. They don't go up and down with the market. He said, well, that's not what I understood. And so clearly, then I come to learn I'm dealing with somebody who does have early kind of dementia or Alzheimer's or something, and hadn't obviously, although I thought he understood what I said, obviously didn't. And so this leads to what should be our best practices around documenting our gifts. So, for example, whenever we're having discussions around gift annuities, charitable trusts, the tax implications of any sort of gift, we should include a reference that, you know, we've encouraged them to seek their own independent counsel before closing the gift, and make sure you have some of this in letter format, not everything verbal over the phone, or at least emails where you've explained tax ramifications perhaps, but you've also encouraged them to seek their counsel. Make sure all that is included in writing and copies in your donor files, and also in your note files of these conversations, you can include that you've given your benefactors these suggestions, but also include it in writing, delivered to the donors, and then copies for your files. Another couple very interesting donors I'm working with right now. One is a gentleman who he's not been declared incompetent, but he cannot remember for the life of him what he told you 10 minutes ago. And yet he has a very large estate. We're talking about a gift involving that large estate. And I'm sitting here concerned that at any moment the kids will want to maybe seek a hearing where he's declared incompetent. We don't know. But the short-term memory is troubling. Now, there are moments in time when we start talking about his assets, his understanding is clear as a bell. And so I'm working with a case right now where I'm documenting everything I say. And if we do close the gift, I will provide a letter saying, you know, we've encouraged you to seek independent counsel on this. I have another case with a donor prospect who is eccentric. I mean, there's no other word to describe it. Incompetent, you know, a $10 million estate. She has great command of information and details about her estate, but I've spent an entire day just talking to her about all sorts of things, but always very emotional. And obviously a very eccentric personality in a variety of ways in terms of her interests, her opinions about matters, and the like. And so you wonder, again, you confirm, are there children on the scene? Is there a power of attorney? So I specifically ask the question, do any of your children have legal authority? And you have to be very careful. You don't want to offend someone when you ask these questions, but you try to carefully weave them in the conversation. So you make sure you are dealing on fair footing here. And so trying to divine incompetency yourself in a situation like that can be very difficult. So let me pause there. I've shared some examples. I'm going to get into some more best practices and other resources, but our time is running even further short. Does anybody on this phone have a situation, an example, a case study that you would like to share? does anybody on the phone use or promote the concept of the ethical will, the legacy statement that I referenced in the case involving the power of attorney? I thought the National Center of Family Philanthropy maybe had some templates for that kind of, I don't know, I've not looked those up, but I for some reason thought that it did. Johnny, are you aware of that?
The National Center has a couple articles in its archives and its resource center about sort of differences between ethical wills and legacy statements and some of those similar kind of softer tools. And then some points them to some other resources outside of NCFP. I know that a couple of the community foundations, Central New York and Houston, have been doing legacy statements with donors, and some other folks have been doing variations on those where they've got some of the donors' legacy information captured outside of the fund agreement as sort of an adjunct tool. I suspect some people may be doing it within the well.
Well, as a reminder, these legacy ethical wills, legacy statements, et cetera, are not per se legal documents, but in the case I talked about, it was cited as some evidence, so to speak, of what their intent was. And it supported the position that the power of attorney did have the ability to continue making gifts from the mother's estate. So it's I think these are good concepts to promote to our donors and benefactors. So, you know, I've alluded to a number of best practices. Let me jump into some of these, and if I miss some best practices that some of you use for your community foundation, we'd love to hear from you. I think first and foremost, of course, we all should have gift acceptance policies and procedures. And maybe a byproduct of this phone call would be to kind of to scan your policies to see if you address any of the issues that we've talked about today. You know, for example, if a donor were to come to you and ask you to be executor of their estate or trustee of their trust, either the organization itself or an individual staff member, does your policies and procedures say yes to that kind of thing? And if yes, what's the protocol for examining whether you want to do it? I am aware of some charities that they discourage staff to take on these responsibilities, but the organization, for example, might be executor of an estate if, in fact, it or trustee of a trust. Well, probably not trustee of a trust. I've not seen that, but executor of an estate if, in fact, there were no children and, say, all of the estate was being left to that particular charity or a fund at your community foundation. That kind of thing. Trusting a trust is a much more complicated creature that could be problematic. Also, do your gift acceptance policies require staff to document their advice giving to donors, benefactors, and especially include reference statements that they should encourage or should share the draft fund agreement, DAF fund agreement, gift annuity agreement, any gift transaction with their lawyer, accountant, advisors before the gift is made or before the document is signed.
Thank you.
People may choose not to consult with their advisors, but I think there should be in your paper trail evidence that you encourage them to do so. You can, as a matter of protocol and best practice, include, you know, in your kind of intake checklist, when you're first getting to know a donor, and, you know, again, these conversations are sensitive, they're personal, but you can, if you start to suspect a problem, you can try to gently inquire if the person's aware of a power of attorney, or what is the role their children play in their lives and decisions. You know, one lesson I've learned over the course of my career is that sometimes children can be very helpful, but sometimes they can be much less than helpful. And so you never know what you're going to run into when you start dealing with children. A lot of children kind of assume that they do have legal authority over their parents, and that's not true. It's not true. And now parents might give children legal authority through a power of attorney or a guardianship matter, or they might name them as joint owner of property. So they might be joint owner of some real estate or a stock account. But otherwise, children don't. And, you know, a lot of the donors we work with, they don't necessarily want to involve their children in their charitable giving decisions. And so it shouldn't be a surprise if when we inquire about children that our donors may not be forthcoming. But believe me, if there's probably any potential source of complaint, quite likely, it could be from the children because they will feel that perhaps any gift they've done to your community foundation is a disinheritance of their funds. And so it's a delicate balance we have, and we can always inquire about children and find out if, in fact, they do have any sort of legal authority over mom and dad's affairs. You know, you can, as indicated earlier in the call, you can document in any gift agreement you sign with the donor that it does cease with the death or resignation, you know, like a donor advised fund, capacity to advise, and so forth. Whether you include incapacity in that agreement or not should be carefully considered, because incapacity may be temporary. So if you do include incapacity, you might want to consider some statement relative to if it's deemed a legal permanent incapacity or temporary, or build in some other language that would give you the opportunity to have the donor return to whatever their formal role was. If you have any arrangements with donors where you're paying gift annuity income, or your trustee of a trust paying income, I would not cut checks. I would have direct deposits to their bank accounts. It's much easier. I've dealt a lot with delivery of checks with people as they are lost and confused or forget things and lose checks. So as much as possible, do direct depositing of any life income plans that you might be involved with. Let me pause there to see if there are any other best practices that any of the community foundations on this call might have they'd want to share with their colleagues.
This is Wendy Usher from the Oregon Community Foundation. One of my questions is, if a donor does not want a POA to serve as the advisor in their place, is there a way to lock that in?
Well, there sure is. You know, at the end of the day, the power of attorney document is under the complete control of the person who sets it up, so long as they're competent. And so when they're competent, they might create either a power of attorney like what I have with my mom, where I'm now her power of attorney, or it could be what's called a springing power of attorney or durable. That is, it kicks into effect only if mom or the person becomes incompetent or incapable. And but they can include in that, they can be as restrictive or not. Power of attorney documents, most state laws allowed for a lot of discretion here. Power of attorneys can be very specific, inclusive, or exclusive, and they can be very general. I mean, the entire range of their financial matters could be handled through it. So to answer your question, yes, that could be done if the person's still competent. Now, if they're not competent anymore, it's kind of locked into what you have right now in writing, and you're going to have to deal with that. And so you have to now have a lawyer take a look at the language to see what you may or may not be able to do.
Great question. Bill, variation on that question. So is there a way to make sure that the fund agreement that the donor signs when they're still competent overrides anything later about a power of attorney or somebody else trying to take control?
Well, that's a good question. You know, at the end of the day, you know, that language, that it ends with their death or resignation, you could include language like I suggested before that it would, you know, that a person who holds a viable, legally compliant power of attorney or guardianship may act on their behalf with regard to advising of this fund. although they may not. Think of it the other way around. You know, just because a person has power of attorney or their guardian doesn't mean they will necessarily be good donor advisors. And, you know, that's a whole different matter that has really nothing to do with their financial or healthcare upkeep. And so I guess as a general rule, my gut would tell me that it's more likely that in the case of permanent disability, that, you know, the advising would stop and that you'd want this fund to become either whatever the plan B of your donor advised fund is, whether it's a rolling over to the unrestricted account or creating a scholarship or a designated fund, that's the moment. So this should be included on your talking point list. So all the community foundations on this call should include this kind of conversation with your donors who are setting up such funds to see what their thoughts and wishes are, and might prompt them to think very carefully about what their plans are relative to powers of attorney and what powers they will give their power of attorney. But I, you know, maybe if the kids are the power of attorney, you know, a lot of parents want their kids to be successor advisors anyway. So if there's alignment of the power of attorney with a child who is going to be a successor advisor anyway, okay, I can see that making a lot of sense. But otherwise, you know, if the person wasn't kind of thought of as a potential successor advisor originally, I'm not sure just because they have power of attorney, unless it's not a permanent incompetency, if it's temporary, you know, another option you would have if temporary is that either grant making from the advice fund will cease, or B, the community foundation's board of directors will act as advisor to the fund if and until such time that the incompetency is deemed to be permanent or the person dies or resigns. And it's quite possible that a power of attorney holder might, included in that power could be the ability of them to have a resignation ability as well. So these are great issues that should be talking points when you're setting up DAFs and thinking about the potentialities of what could transpire. We're running short of time, and there are a few resources I want to make sure to share with the audience. There's a very helpful website. It's a group called the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. You know, oftentimes we like to give references to professional advisors to assist our donors. Well, you can go to the website of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, and these are lawyers who specialize particularly in Medicare, Medicaid qualification rules, special needs trusts, and the issues around the legal documentation and protections for persons who are incapacitated. And that website has a lot of helpful resources, publications, and it has a helpful search tool because lawyers can become members of this National Academy. So if you have a lawyer in your community who's a member of the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys, most likely he or she would be a good resource to recommend to your donors who might need somebody with that particular skill set. You know, quite often you're aware of lawyers in your communities who are prominent estate planning lawyers. They know the tax law, they know the state law around documentation, but they may not have this other niche of expertise relative to spatial needs. And that's where the National Academy of Elder Lawyers really, really is helpful. So this is, in a sense, a bit of a subset of the general genre of estate planning lawyers. So I encourage you to do that. Some other resources would include the National Association of Charitable Gift Planners, NACGP, that has the model standards and other ethical statements. The website of the independent sector has those, some helpful ethical information too that I referenced earlier. Your state attorney general, and I know some states don't have necessarily an attorney general, that whatever office in your state oversees protection of the elderly against business scams and other kinds of problematic behaviors in the real world. You know, there are a lot of hotlines and resources available for these folks. So just having that at your fingertips, providing that helpful information to folks that you think are in need, again, through your state attorney general office might be helpful. The website of the AARP, I'm now a proud member of AARP, and I'm old enough anyway. And
they have a lot of helpful resources too. So I thought I'd share some of those. Does anybody else on the call have any helpful resources you'd like to share?
Just as a reminder, this is Tony from the National Center. In the invitation out for this call, there were two resources that were from presentations to the National Association of Charitable Gift Planners. One called Stewarding Donors with Dementia has some really great practical advice on the verbal communication and just how you need to sort of say things and repeat things to donors with dementia, although certainly with everybody's busy schedules, even following those for lots of other donors would make sense. So it's on page 10 of that, Stewarding Donors with Dementia, some other great advice on working with those donors. Any other folks have helpful policies or tips they use internally before we wrap? Okay. Phil, we had an email question in if the case study you mentioned in Indiana, the story, is something that about that somewhere, the two brothers.
Yeah, absolutely. Happy to share.
If you can email me something, we'll get it out to the group and in a follow-up email. I'll also tell everybody that Phil Purcell also powers or is one of the powers behind the legal help desk that the Indiana Philanthropy Alliance runs as an alternate to the legal help desk that the Council on Foundations has or a couple other organizations, and community foundations across the country can sign up for help from that legal help desk. So if you look for the Indiana Philanthropy Alliance and then look in their resources section, you'll find Foundation Legal Help Desk, and there's a couple different tiers of annual subscriptions that can get you 6 or 10 inquiries a year and full answers a good number of those. And so if you want to dive deeper into work with Phil or other experts like him as you're trying to remodel your fund agreements or things, know that there's some legal counsel available that are well versed in community foundation brilliance and weirdness all at the same time. Everybody, this is the last topical call and last program for community foundations from NCFP in 2018. The topical calls will kick off again in 2019 in the second Tuesday of each month. The e-newsletter went out about a week ago, and it has a link to some of the upcoming programs in 2019, and we'll have more things out in the early part of January. Thank you, Phil, so much for taking time out of your travel schedule to talk with our Community Foundation folks. We'll send out your contact information along with that Indiana case study and the Indiana Philanthropy Alliance Help Desk. Thank you all for your time to listen in, to participate in your busy Decembers. We hope all of you have a lovely and prosperous holiday season and a great year end. Thank you all for your time. Have a great year.
Thank you, Tony. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.